I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi there, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and this is Women Who Travel. After exploring the depths of the ocean recently, we thought this would be a good opportunity to take to the skies in honor of Women's History Month and discover more about Amelia Earhart and Bessie Coleman. Amelia, of course, is known for her record-breaking flights. Brave Bessie is known for her daring barnstorming stunts. Both were good publicists, self-promoters, and had ingenious schemes to fund their own flights.
It's a matter of keeping these women in the limelight, acknowledging who they were as pioneers, as pioneering women who were resilient, that had visions, they saw no limits for themselves.
As a pilot and as a curator and as someone who's working in the aviation space, what do these two women mean to you? How do you see them?
They're such strong women who really made their own way in the world against all these odds, especially Bessie.
I'm talking to Dorothy Cochran, a curator at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington.
You know, the average woman at that time, whether black or white, was tied to the family. They wanted to do something different. Once they both found aviation, it's what they wanted to do. So I think you look at them as always looking at life differently, wanting a different life for themselves, and then being able to persevere and make it happen in the 1920s.
I'd love to hear a little bit about you first, because you come from an aviation background yourself. You're a curator, but you're also a pilot.
When I first came to the museum, I did not have an aviation background. And so one of the things I did was decide to get my pilot license so that I would understand and basically have a future here.
That's so fascinating. So you felt like you needed to know what it was like to be in a cockpit and fly a plane to really be able to understand the work that you were doing from the standpoint of a curator and from how you approach these archives. That context felt important.
It was important because at the time, the museum was, most of the staff were men, and certainly in my aeronautics department and the people I was working with at the collections restoration unit were people who had been in the military, either as pilots or as mechanics or things like that. Getting that license made them really take me more seriously.
We've done shows about the sea and sort of adventures on the sea. And I've talked to women who have climbed Everest, and all these sort of adventures are really quite bewitching. And often for them quite, I think it almost becomes an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that flying is the same?
Oh, absolutely. It is an addiction. There are people that just live for flying. They fly as often as they can, and it's their favorite thing to do. So all their friends, all their experiences are based around their flying.
This episode, we're honoring two aviators. Who are they? And tell me a little bit about what they have in common.
Bessie Coleman was the first African-American to earn a pilot license. And to do so, she had to leave the United States in order to be able to get training. Amelia Earhart is a contemporary of Bessie Coleman. They were essentially of the same age and working to create a career. The difference is, of course, that Earhart had built a real career and Bessie was still struggling to create one for herself.
While Bessie was a stunt performer first and foremost, Amelia was more set out on record breaking. Both spectacles, but with different intentions.
Yeah, Bessie, she wanted to be a stunt performer. She wanted to do barnstorming, and her goal was to open her own flying school so that African Americans would have a place to learn to fly and not be discriminated against as she had been. So that was her goal. Amelia, she got her license about the same time in 1921, but it wasn't until she was selected to be the woman to become the first to fly across the Atlantic as a passenger that she was able then to get notoriety and get a good promoter.
Amelia's story is such a thing of myth, but what sort of celebrity was she when she was kind of at the peak of her fame before she went missing?
Amelia was seen as a great promoter of aviation, as a record setter, and as an extraordinary woman. And she made a concerted effort to build upon her records, always trying to do something new and different that would not only give her experience, but would also land her in the headlines, in the news. Bessie was, you know, not known. She was not covered by any white newspapers as a rule. And she just really wasn't known. Bessie never got the chance to prove herself, whereas Amelia did.
I'm familiar with Bessie, but it's only through sort of years of working at Traveller and being curious about this sort of corner of women's history. And she doesn't get talked about in the same context as Amelia, but yet you say they're peers, but met such different challenges.
Well, for Bessie Coleman, it's all about discrimination. In the early 19-teens, discrimination, segregation were legal at the time. Certainly in the United States. And there was no opportunity for African Americans to learn to fly. Simply no instructors would teach them. And they did not have the means to go out and buy airplanes and learn on their own.
Tell me a little bit more about her background, because she's the first African American woman to hold a pilot's license. She also identified as Native American, correct?
Yes. Her father had Native American relatives. And then her mother was African American. So she did become both the first African American and indigenous American pilot. She was born in Texas, worked in the cotton fields. The whole family eventually, except for her father went off to Oklahoma, back to his indigenous family. The rest of the family eventually participated in the great migration of Southerners up north and ended up in Chicago. And she got a job as a manicurist, which was, you know, something that was done in the Black community at that time. But she was unsettled and wanted to do more. And so selecting the idea of becoming a pilot was truly extraordinary, daunting, and seemingly impossible. She worked within her Black community, and so she did have support there. One of the big supporters was the African-American newspaper, The Defender, in Chicago. The editor, Mr. Abbott, he saw it as an opportunity basically to highlight an African-American who was pursuing something different. So it was promotional for him. But it worked to Bessie's advantage as well, because he helped her with ideas and support to get that license and to get started.
Coming up, how Bessie Coleman had to go to France to get her pilot's license. One barrier was broken, but there were many more to overcome.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions, and they make you see the scene. but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners, subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforest of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tires, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
She had to go to France because no Americans, no white Americans would teach African Americans how to fly at that time, and especially an African American woman. So she took French lessons while she was in Chicago. She saved money. She was able to get money from family and friends, and she went to France. And there she was enrolled in the Caudron School of Aviation, which was one of the premier schools of the time in France. And it took her 7 months, but she did learn to fly there and received her license, becoming the first African-American to receive a license from the international group Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, which was then recognized as an international license that would allow her to fly anywhere in the world. And that was important because she could bring that back to the United States and she could fly back in the United States. She came home, she went back to Europe again to get more training, flew in the Netherlands and also in Germany.
It sounds like she sort of was, you know, part of a greater movement of African Americans who traveled to Europe, you know, I think like James Baldwin relocating to Paris a couple of decades later, you know, to experience greater freedoms and then use it as a vantage point to scrutinize the racism and segregation in their home of the US. How did she take what she learned in Europe back to America?
She brought back her aviation skills, but in order to put on a show to earn money in aviation, she really needed some support to plan flying exhibitions and join established exhibitions. She really became the first African American to put on a public show, first in New York at Curtis Field and then out in Chicago as well.
How was she able to pull off the shows that she did? How was she challenging these Jim Crow practices?
Well, she would approach people who were putting on shows, or she would say, I'm an African American pilot and I would like to put on an exhibition. One way or another, she would try to negotiate with people who were putting on these shows to try to be able to fly in them. They might be an all-black show. She could perform sometimes in a mixed show and then before audiences of both races. The hardest thing to do was to be able to find an aircraft that was airworthy. The aircraft of the day that most barnstormers were flying was the Curtis Jenny, which was surplus from World War I. And by the early 20s, they were aging and they were always in need of repair and they were always a bit sketchy. And because she didn't have a lot of money, she couldn't afford one that might have been in the best shape. So it's a matter of borrowing, renting airplanes. She bought one airplane, but unfortunately had an accident in it on the first time that she tried to do a show.
You mentioned barnstorming, which is a very visual word, but I actually can't describe what I think it is. Can you explain what type of stunt barnstorming was and what sort of spectacle that people would come out to see her do?
In this time frame, most people have not seen an airplane, and their introduction to an airplane is via a barnstormer, who is a person who has an aircraft and travels from town to town, from farmer's field to farmer's field, to put on a show, which is normally loops and rolls, figure eights, climbing high and diving low, and putting on a spectacle, scaring people, thrilling people, and then also taking people up for rides and giving them their first opportunity to fly. And it's dangerous, thrilling, all in one.
I mean, Bessie just sounds like the most radical woman for so many reasons, for challenging segregation, for doing these crazy stunts that people had never even seen. People hadn't even been up in planes, and there was this woman, you know, doing loops in the air. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. Yet she doesn't get the same place in history as Amelia.
Well, she doesn't get the same place in history because of discrimination, but also because her time was cut short.
What was the accident that Bessie lost her life in?
When Bessie was scheduled to fly in a Jacksonville, Florida air show in April of 1926, she had just bought a Jenny aircraft and her mechanic had brought it to Jacksonville. And they went up in it together. And she was a passenger at that point because they were looking for the right spot where they could do a parachuting act. She would fly the airplane on the day of the event. And then another person would perform a parachute jump out of the plane. So they were scoping out the best spot for the jumping out portion of the parachute jump. And unfortunately, the plane, for some reason, went out of control. And because Bessie had been looking over the side of the aircraft and did not have a seatbelt on, she was tossed out of the airplane and fell to her death. And her mechanic had lost control of the aircraft. It crashed and he also died. It was one of many of this type of accidents of barnstorming, which is a reason that regulation and rules did then start to be implemented because of these tragedies. I think Bessie was on the cusp of being able to establish a barnstorming career and establish that school. And who knows if how different things might have been. But then her legacy was taken up by African-American pilots in the 30s. So she left a legacy that then others picked up on. And we honor her in the Pioneers of Flight Gallery.
After the break, Amelia in her own words.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Amelia Earhart Putnam lands at Newark after her epical 2,500-mile hop from Los Angeles, breaking Ruth Nichols' distance record and setting a new time mark for women.
It took me about 19 hours and a few minutes to make the trip. I wish I could have done it faster.
There's quite a lot of archive still out there. How does she come across in all of those newsreels and interviews? What's her personality like?
She was actually very good with the public. She understood intuitively how to get her message across, be taken seriously, but she came across quite well in the media.
Well, I carried some water, of course, because my cockpit is very warm, and I carried a sandwich in case. I didn't eat it, though. I carried some hot chocolate and the old reliable tomato juice.
It sounds like she knew how to play the game.
She did. And some of that was her own personality. And of course, some of that was with George Putnam being the promoter behind the scene. And they worked together to create this persona and to sell it. But she was serious about it. You know, it wasn't a false creation. This is who she was.
And George Putnam was a very powerful publisher, right?
He was one of the major publishers, publicists. He came from a publishing family, and then he became a publicist in aviation. He had already been a publicist for Charles Lindbergh. So he understood completely what needed to be done and was very good at his job.
And clearly he must have, you know, that's quite progressive for a man to take on a woman pilot in this time, based on everything we've discussed. He must have seen, I don't know, do you think what was it that he saw in Amelia? Was it dollar signs? Did he see, what was the potential he saw? It must have been some self-interest there.
Oh, he certainly saw dollar signs when they were first looking for the first woman who was going to be the passenger to go across the Atlantic Ocean with two male pilots in 1928. They were looking for what they quoted as saying as the right sort of woman. They wanted someone with experience who was already a pilot to be taken seriously, but they needed someone who they felt had, and that you also had to have an impeccable background, no skeletons in the closet, that sort of thing, and also be able then to present on camera to the public.
On May 20th, 1932, Earhart flew from Newfoundland. Her destination was to be Paris, but her flight was disrupted by a petrol leak, which forced her to land in Donegal.
I believe I saw land first about the middle. I decided to come down anyway in the best available pasture. I got down without any trouble and taxied to the front door of a surprised farmer's cottage. After receiving a real Irish welcome, I took a Paramount plane to London.
Public speaking and the lectures and tours and advertisements were really how she made her money. Her record setting rarely offered a prize of money, but she did that to become known, and there she was in the newsreels. So she became a celebrity. In 1937, Amelia Earhart wanted to fly around the world, and she wanted to do that as close to the equator as possible. She had already become the first woman to fly solo and nonstop across the Atlantic Ocean in 1932. She had to make headlines. She had to set records. And so this continued then into 1937, when she decided to fly around the world. And she took with her her navigator, Fred Noonan, who had been a former Pan American Airlines navigator. And so the two of them embarked on this flight, and they made it quite a distance around the world to Lay, New Guinea. And they were then en route to Howland Island, which was another 2,500-mile flight, when they disappeared and did not arrive at Howland.
So she takes this last flight, and the now very famous disappearance takes place. Why Do you think that helps keep her in the limelight? Do you think that that lore of her story and that mystery has kept us so fascinated with her, perhaps even more so than the actual work that she succeeded in doing?
We have to understand that her disappearance is still one of the great mysteries of the 20th century. So the idea is, you know, they disappear and the search goes on and no one finds her, nothing. And how does that resonate then for the rest of the time?
What is it that has captured our imaginations when it comes to the disappearance? Now you have people who are still racing to solve that mystery. Why are we so fascinated with the fact that they disappeared, with the adventure, with where they disappeared, and coming up with all of these theories?
I think because she was so famous, because the rest of the world was rooting for her to fly around the world. And the fact that you could hear her radio transmissions, her last radio transmissions, and according to the Coast Guard who received them, they were anchored off of Howland Island, where they were awaiting her to come and land and refuel her for her next leg of her flight, which would have taken her to Hawaii. You know, they have heard her. They know that she's coming closer, and then she doesn't arrive. And it's just that sheer shock that they have disappeared without a trace. A huge search was put on, the largest sea and air search ever at the time, and there was nothing was found.
What are some of the prevailing theories?
The logical theory is that she was lost, yeah, on the way to Howland Island. And then there are all the other myths and theories. You know, the idea that perhaps she flew to a different island because she couldn't find Howland Island. And maybe she flew back to Saipan or the Marshall Islands, which were several hours away from where she was when she said, "I have only a half an hour of fuel left." So the idea that she was, crashed somewhere else and was captured by the Japanese and killed by them or put in prison have no basis in reality, as far as I'm concerned.
There's one that she's survived and was working on some sort of pineapple plantation. Is that one I've heard?
Yes, there's one that, you know, she landed somewhere else and either Saipan or the Philippines. I think that one somehow gets her to the Philippines, and I'm not sure exactly how she got there, but the idea that she's running a pineapple plantation there. There's another theory that also says that she survived, and I forget where it says she landed, but that she eventually made her way back to New Jersey and lived under the assumed name of Irene Balaam. There was a woman named Irene Balaam who objected to that strenuously.
She would if she was pretending to be Irene Balaam.
Well, she would. But on the other hand, if you were Irene Balaam, she went and got a court order to tell people to stop calling her Amelia Earhart.
It's funny, as you're describing this, I can't help but think of conspiracy theories of 2024. So, you know, in a way, we've never changed.
No, you know, when you don't have an answer, when you don't have an actual physical piece of evidence, then you have this vacuum because you don't know what happened. And it just gets filled. People just don't want to let go of it.
Amelia Earhart pops up in the news semi-frequently.
There have been searches for Amelia Earhart ongoing. But in recent years, modern technology has made it a bit more practical, the idea of using submersible sonar equipment. And so last fall, a group called Deep Sea Vision went out into an area not too far in the vicinity of Howland Island to do exploration with one of these underwater submersible sonar pieces. And they went down for a 30-day mission. They came up with a sonar image, which I think most people have seen now. It does have a vague resemblance to an aircraft, but it could be something else. It could be an anchor. It could be a boat. In order to go any further, they're going to need to go back and do more sonar and do actual photography of whatever this is that they have found on the floor. And they're not the first to do this. There's a group called Nauticos, which has also made three missions to different areas around Howland Island. And they are still refining their scientific exploration. So it's an ongoing thing. It's just a constant effort to try to acknowledge earlier women's roles. It still remains always difficult to get women to be the headlining news article. There's no doubt about that. We still struggle with that. We want to honor women. We always want to take that opportunity to bring their stories to life. It's always good to remind people of where some of these strengths and where some of these original pioneers went in order to persevere, to live their lives and become the legacies that they are.
Perfect. Dorothy, this was a fascinating conversation. Next week, we're talking to a TV host who's obsessed with being out in the wilderness, Dr. Rae Wynn Grant. She'll be chatting about her new memoir, Wildlife, Finding My Purpose in an Untamed World. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hanna. Our engineers are Jake Loomis, Nick Pittman, and James Yost. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. See you next week.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
From PRX.